The 1998 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session 111, Mary Poppins and the Return of God the Mother, a paper presented by Carolyn Pearson, chaired by Shirlene Hardy Barlow. This is a 60-minute program taped on a 90-minute tape, so the last half of the second side will be blank.
Good morning. My name is Shirlene Hardy Barlow, and I'd like to welcome you to the 1998 Sunstone Symposium, and particularly this session, Mary Poppins and the Return of God the Mother. I have been asked to remind you that attendance at these classes are with ticket or badge only, so thank you for honoring that. I feel deeply honored to be able to introduce someone who probably needs no introduction to most of you, for Carolyn Pearson is indeed a legacy. Her gifts in writing and speaking and performing have thrilled and inspired hundreds and thousands of individuals from every walk of life. Her works with which we are probably most familiar include her first book, which was a wonderful book on poetry called Beginnings, and it sold 150,000 copies. Goodbye, I Love You was another wonderful book, 150,000 copies, probably more than that, hardback and paperback. And her wonderful one-woman play, Mother Wove the Morning, in which she plays 16 women throughout history, and they all are searching for the face of Mother God. She has performed this play over 300 times throughout the country and abroad, and 3 years ago she produced it into a wonderful video. And that won an award from Booklist as one of the top 25 videos of the year. In 1996, she published A Stranger for Christmas. In 1997, Morning Glory Mother. And both of those will be TV movies. I'm excited to see those. In the fall of 1998... will release The Modern Magi and The Lesson. Other of her wonderful writings is the book One on the Seesaw, The Ups and Downs of a Single Parent Family, several books on history of Utah women, a juvenile novel, a book on diary keeping, several books of humor, a variety of children's stage musicals, two commissioned by Robert Redford Sundance Theater, and numerous educational movies. One that has become a classic and received many international awards, Cipher in the Snow. She is a great speaker and much in demand, and recently she addressed the National Conference of Unity Ministers, an international conference of Sisters of Mercy, and a national conference of women judges. And we thank you, Carol, for taking time out of your busy schedule to speak to us today. And the time is now yours.
Thank you so much. It's really wonderful to be with you. I'm glad that you got up early to get here. Last night I was so excited when Elbert introduced me as one of the theologians. I thought, gee, I thought I barely qualified as a so-called scholar. I want to make one little quick announcement. I am no longer performing Mother Wove the Morning, and I have contributed a bunch of Mormon Women's Forum to raise some money for them. So any of you who have not seen or read this, you can get cut-rate prices. The book which is usually almost $9 for $5, and we'll have some right here at the back. I'll be glad to sign for anybody. The video marked down to $20 if anybody wants that. Whoa. And these excellent, wonderful T-shirts at $7. And I'm only pushing this because it's the Mormon Women's Forum. They get all the money and not me. So anyway, that's a good thing for you to do. Well, it seems that that an angel approaches Mary in heaven and says, "Oh, Mary, Mary, you had such a wonderful experience on earth. I have been so anxious to talk to you. Tell me, how did it feel when you actually became the mother of God?" And Mary casts her eyes down and she says, "Well, I was hoping for a girl." Now, humorists have proven that we laugh at things because of their absurdity. And how absurd is it that we should actually hope for a girl when it comes to anything really, really big and important? Well, that is indeed absurd. But that is exactly what I am doing. That is what I have spent a great deal of my life focusing on, is hoping for a girl in terms of what I have addressed thematically in my life on an ongoing basis as filling the motherless house. I don't know why, but from my earliest consciousness, I looked around and I said, "What's wrong with this picture? Where is the validation of the feminine? Where is the mother in our divine parentage?" And so the concept of filling the motherless house has been one that I have addressed within myself and in my work consistently. I have found, too, that this, of course, is a universal hunger, even where it's not recognized, and that it pops up in our collective unconscious in some rather interesting ways. And it's been very clear to me that in our popular culture, and particularly in a long list of motion pictures, we play out for ourselves this drama that we're also playing out inside, and that hopefully we are gathering the energy to play out on the outside in our society, in our organizations, in our churches, of transforming the patriarchal family through the receiving of the divine magical woman. And I've chosen to share with you three movies that we all know that do this very thing. And as I rehearse for you generally the stories of these movies, I want you to pay attention to how you see these same elements being worked out in the society that you live in and in the church that you live in. We could look at such movies as Peter Pan, where Captain Hook needs a mother so badly that he goes out and steals one. Or Into the West, a wonderful, mystical Irish film. But those that I'm going to talk to you about are The Sound of Music, The Secret Garden, and one of my favorite all-time movies, Mary Poppins. Well, it is so obvious, once we change our focus just a little bit and look at these, we say, "Ah, duh, of course, this is what's happening." And in The Sound of Music, how obvious is this? Here we are in the very sad patriarchal household, highly militaristic. Captain Von Trapp, his wife died, he runs the house as the military. Each morning the children are drilled in their studies, even through the summers. Each afternoon they march around the grounds, breathing deeply. They respond to his whistle. Discipline and order are the rule. The children wear uniforms, and he will be called captain. You may have noticed that titles are very important in patriarchal thought. And the military is a great example of patriarchy. The last talk I gave here, and that was subsequently an article in Sunstone, Could Feminism Have Saved the Nephites, shows... Now, why do you laugh? You laugh at all my titles here. Absurd. It is absurd, but I tell you it's true. It's the unavoidable link between patriarchy and militarism. Well, into this Von Trapp patriarchal sad household, as the plot thickens, here comes the magical woman, down from the hills, the holy woman, right out of the convent. And the first word she speaks at the door is just so interesting. The door opens, there's the butler, and she says, "I'm the new governess." And he says, "I'm the old butler." Well, this is really a very interesting meeting of the old masculine and the new feminine. Well, who is she, this holy, magical woman? Well, she can't resist singing. She makes the other nuns laugh. She's a flibbertigibbet, a will-o'-the-wisp, a clown. She adores the animals, strong contact with nature. She's a headache. She's an angel. She's a girl. Oh, good, I was hoping for a girl. And indeed, a girl she is. And she is a troublemaker. Oh, do we need our girl troublemakers? The captain is not pleased. She brings a female presence into the household, dancing and singing, and she sings of very, very feminine things. Raindrops on roses, do you remember that? Whiskers on kittens, bright copper kettles, warm woolen mittens, wild geese that fly with the moon on their wings. Girls in white dresses with blue satin sashes. Well, she's not singing of boys in khaki uniforms with swastikas on their sleeves. She gives us very, very contrasting feminine images to the backdrop that we see this played out against. She works her magic with the children, and in a maid point, they sing the song that Maria taught them. And the captain is so touched, so amazed. And he says, "You brought music back into the house. I'd forgotten. I want you to stay. Please stay." Well, what a day it will be when our patriarchy says to us, "You brought the feminine back into the house? I'd forgotten. Please, stay." Well, the captain and Maria fall in love. Of course, Maria doesn't want to ruin his relationship with the Baroness, so she leaves. And again, the house is sad and motherless. Music and spirit gone. And what do the children do? Well, do they just sit there? Indeed, they don't. They go to the abbey to get her back. Well, children should not be passive when they need their mother. They have a right to go knock on the abbey door and demand that she come back. And I have a right to knock on any door and demand my mother back. Well, Maria comes back on her own, and we have this wedding. And do you recall the melody that great, huge, almost tabernacle organ is playing as she comes down the aisle in her incredible dress? The organ is playing the tune of Without the Words. How do you solve a problem like Maria? Which, again, is its contrast to what we now know, that, I mean, she's the answer. Well, so what... How do you solve a problem like Levina, or Janice, or maybe Carolyn? Well, the answer is so clear. You fall in love with them, and you marry them, and you invite them and allow them and support them in helping to transform the patriarchal household into a partnership, and joy and singing and music and spirit will prevail. I hereby invite the patriarchy to fall in love with me, and I promise to be a very devoted and delightful and highly useful partner. Well, from the wedding we cut to the army marching, the military patriarchy will not let Captain Von Trapp off the hook, force a commission on him into the Navy of the Third Reich. The fatherland, which the Third Reich was, the fatherland, will be served. But the captain now has greater resources to refuse. And he is now in the domain of the mother. With the help of the holy woman, who came down from the hills to bless his life, and with the help of the holy women in the abbey who sabotaged the Nazis' cars, the captain and his family climb the mountain to freedom, and they are a transformed unit. Moving now to the secret garden, I first recognized what I was seeing, the same story as I saw this play on Broadway and then as I studied the motion picture. We have, again here, a very, very sad motherless house. The mother died 10 years before in childbirth brought on by falling from a swing in her garden. Archibald Craven, the widower, is desolate. He's hunchback and has a broken heart. He will not see people. He leaves every spring and can only bear to be there in the wintertime because spring and summer remind him of his lost love. He is in very, very deep grief. The kind of grief, in fact, that the Kabbalah tells us God is in without his Shekhinah. The son, Colin, is crippled emotionally, and he thinks physically. He doesn't get out of bed. He says, I'm going to die. There is in his room a large portrait of his dead mother. It's covered, though, with a drape, because, he says, she smiles too much. The windows also are nailed shut, so the spores won't get in and trouble his lungs. Mother Nature is banished from his room, as well as his biological mother draped on the wall. And this is run exactly like military. However, this one is run by a woman. Mrs. Medlock, played by Maggie Smith, has a huge investment in keeping young Master Colin sick, supporting the status quo. Do we know any women like this who run the patriarchy like good little patriarchs and have a huge investment in not rocking the boat, because that's their job and that's where they get their acknowledgement. Of course, again, the plot thickens. And into this sad, sad patriarchal household comes Mary Lennox, an uppity little girl, 10-year-old girl from India. Her parents died in the earthquake. Her mother was the twin sister of Archibald's wife and Colin's mother. And she has come to be in the care of her uncle, who can't bear to see her because, again, she reminds him of his lost love. Now, she, too, is a troublemaker. Oh, those girls, what are we going to do with them? She turns the household upside down. In her voiceover, in narration, she says, "The house seemed dead. Seemed like a spell had been cast upon it." She is told not to go poking around. But she does. She goes into rooms she is not supposed to go in. She goes into the mother's room that has been locked up. And it's just like her own mother's room at home. These twin sisters had the exact same room. And in the mother's room, she finds a key. And she steals this key. Now, these girls, these women should know that there are keys that you just are not supposed to mess around with. But Mary Lennox finds this key and she steals it out of the mother's room. And, of course, outside she discovers this garden within a garden, this hidden little area that was the mother's private, beautiful garden when she was alive. And after the death, the master ordered it shut up forever. And no one has been in it for 10 years. She finds a robin who will show her the way to the door. She uses her stolen key, and it opens the door to the mother's garden. And, oh, as we move into this dead garden, it is so dramatic. All we see is deadness. And it's presided over by the statue of an old woman. And in the background, we have wistful female voices singing in a plaintive cry. But Mary looks down and there's one shoot of green. Just one shoot showing her that the garden is not dead. And this is indeed how I felt as I looked around and saw all the spiritual feminine that I longed for. All the concept of the Divine Mother. Dead. Except for a little shoot here and a little shoot there. And I remember when I read Brother Arrington's first histories about some of the early Mormon women, that was one of my first little glimpses of the green shoot. And I thought, maybe it's not completely dead. And so in my heart, and I have used this phrase even, that the feminine has not been buried. It's been planted. And it is growing and greening. Well, Mary makes friends with Dickon, another young boy there. And together, they go in and tend the garden. And of course, men, boys, have their role to play in all of these dramas. The men who say, "Oh, I am missing something, as well as my mother's, sister's, daughter's missing something. I am missing something." Well, here Mary and Dickon together go in and tend the garden. And in this marvelous time-lapse photography, we see the garden grow. And it is just so thrilling to see the green and the flowers and this whole area come to life. And at the same time, we see little cousin Colin coming to life. And he says, "Maybe I'm not ill." And he walks even. And now we see these little kids in this magic ritual circle, like a prayer circle, to contact the absent father and ask him to come back. And the father receives this prayer, has a vision, hears the voice of his wife saying, "I'm in the garden with Colin." And he says, "I must go tonight." So he immediately goes there unexpectedly, and what does he find? The son is not in his bed where he's supposed to be, has always been. The portrait of the mother is unveiled, and there she is, smiling. The light is coming into the room where the bars have been taken off, and he says, "What happened?" And Medlock says, "Oh, it's that child, my lord. She's created absolute havoc here." Remember that word, havoc. She says, "I've tried to control her, but she does just as she pleases." Oh, no, a girl is out of control. What are we going to do? Well, the father goes out and finds his son in the garden, walking whole, healthy, and walks to him for this wonderful, moving reunion. And the father says to Mary, "Mary, you brought us back to life. You did something I thought no one could do. I won't shut the garden up again. Believe me." Well, what a day it will be when our patriarchy looks at the garden that we have caused and insisted to bloom, and they say to us, "Thank you. Thank you for making the mother's garden grow. We will never close it up again." Well, on to Mary Poppins, with whom I have such fun. And again, here we move in on this very rigid patriarchy. Military, we see Admiral Boom, head of His Majesty's Navy, keeping things ship-shape. "More spit and polish, that's what needed around here," he says. And then we see Mr. Banks, who works at the bank, another good patriarchal institution. And as he comes into his little tidy Victorian home, and he's singing, and you remember, "It's grand to be an Englishman in 1910, King Edward's on the throne, it's the age of men. I'm the lord of my castle, the sovereign, the liege. I treat my subjects, servants, children, wife, with a firm but gentle hand, noblesse oblige." Well, this sounds like people we know. Sounds like institutions we know. This is the age of men. Now, there's another wonderful, and we will come to love Mr. Banks. Make no mistake about that. He is really a wonderful, wonderful guy. We meet Bert, played by Dick Van Dyke. Now, you remember this, haven't you? You've all seen Mary Poppins. It's been a while, perhaps. And he's the counterculture, the masculine counterculture to the patriarchy. He's not attached to any institution. He's an itinerant worker, draws sidewalk paintings, is a chimney sweep, whatever is demanded there. And we have lots of men like him in our patriarchy. There are a lot of them here today, and I am very grateful for them. Well, Bert tells us, Dick Van Dyke tells us, "The winds in the east, the mist's coming in, like something is brewing, about to begin." Well, something is brewing. And we go to Cherry Tree Lane, number 17, to see what it is. "Bit of heavy weather brewing there," he says. We live on 17 Cherry Tree Lane. Heavy weather is brewing right here. And what do we find as we first go in that house? There is no nanny in the house. This is a motherless house. Well, where is Mrs. Banks? She's there, but she is powerless. She is not a presence in the household. She defers to him constantly, saying things like, "How clever of you, I would have muddled the whole thing." She is very much a fascinating woman. And she, in fact, physically is gone a very great deal. She is out doing what? Getting votes for women. She's a suffragette. She wears her bandolier, her ribbon that says Votes for Women. And she comes in saying, we had the most glorious meeting. Mrs. Wedderburn Allen chained herself to the Prime Minister's carriage. Mrs. Ensley was carried off to prison, singing and scattering pamphlets on the way. I think it was 20 years ago that Sonia chained herself to the Seattle Temple. It is not my style to do any chaining, but I have been known to scatter pamphlets and books and plays and an occasional talk or two on my way. And Mrs. Banks comes in singing, from Kensington to Billingsgate, we hear the restless cries. From every corner of the land, womankind arise. Political equality and equal rights with men. Take heart, for Mrs. Pankhurst has been clapped in irons again. No more the meek and servience we. We're fighting for our rights militantly. Never you fear. Cast off the shackles of yesterday. Oh, that is just so wonderful. Now, Glynis Johns is so charming, so sweet and charming that we do not realize how subversive she is. Well, they must hire a new nanny. And Mr. Banks wants a nanny just like him. A British nanny must be a general. Tradition, discipline, and rules must be the tools. Without them, disorder, catastrophe, anarchy. Anarchy. In short, a ghastly mess. Well, he wants more masculinity. I have been interested the way that Alan Alden put it. He said, our society suffers from testosterone poisoning. Just meaning that we're out of balance. But Mr. Banks wants more testosterone. He wants more patriarchy in his household. So he is going to choose a nanny just like him. But the children know what they need. Again, just like in The Sound of Music, the children know. We know, you and I, children, in our household of faith, in our societal family, in our own hearts, we know what we need. Well, little Jane and Michael know what's missing in their household, and they go about it to make it their business. They don't say that the brethren take care of it. That's their business. No, this is their home. They know what they need. And so they create an advertisement. And, you know, they ask for somebody with a cheery disposition. Play games, sing songs. Love us as a son or daughter. Don't scold or dominate us. Dominate, that is a rich word that we could get into if we had the time. Well, Mr. Banks takes their advertisement and tears it up. Puts it in the fireplace. And what does it do? Magically, this is the first magic that we see, magically it wafts its way up the chimney like a little prayer and ascends to heaven. And at that moment, Admiral Boom, out here on his ship, says, the wind has changed. Seems to be coming in from a new quarter. Yes, the wind has changed, and the plot thickens. And down from heaven comes the holy woman, the magical woman, just what they asked for. Now, I must add here, Julie Andrews is not really Heavenly Mother in disguise. She just got two of these excellent, delicious parts in Sound of Music and now in Mary Poppins. Well, the little kids see her out the window, and Michael says, oh, perhaps it's a witch. Well, that's what we call any woman who is powerful, who seems to have spiritual power. And we have been known occasionally to burn a witch at the steakhouse. Well, Mary Poppins enters. She takes over and she gets the job. She does not claim to be divine. She does not claim to be supernatural, only supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, and practically perfect in every way. She promises that she will stay until the wind changes. And she sets up her shop there, produces from her handbag things that are very rich in symbolism. that we don't have time to go into, but sometime take a look at the movie with your kids or your grandkids or just yourself, and let your imagination just play with everything there. Is archetypally so rich. Well, she brings warmth, joy, fun. As you will remember, just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. So fun and joy are absolute part and parcel of what she has come to offer here. And I submit that if indeed feminism and ultimately partnership are not more fun than patriarchy, then why bother? Well, she goes about creating fun magic. She levitates the toys, pops through Bert's paintings, does the horse race, creates laughter. And this is noticed. Mr. Banks, like the captain, is not pleased. He says, Mrs. Banks says, since Mary Poppins came, the most extraordinary thing seems to have come over the household. The children, the servants are singing, being remarkably gracious to one another. Now, we do know from studies that the female brain, whether it's innately or from socialization, produces more cooperation than competition. And this is exactly, in fact, what Mr. Banks calls slipshod, sugary female thinking. Nevertheless, this is just what the household needs, what they cried out for. Now, Mr. Banks is losing control of his family. Patriarchy is losing control. He calls it moral disintegration. Mary Poppins, however, in a very important statement, seeing his distress, brings some empathy, sympathy, even to what he is experiencing, and says to the children, sometimes the person that we love, through no fault of his own, can't see past the end of his own nose. Now, I suggest that Mr. Banks in particular and patriarchy in general are short-sighted. Mr. Banks takes the children to the bank to educate them. And there we have this little explosion because Michael refuses to give the tuppence over to the bank. He wants to feed the birds instead of investing in railroads. This causes an uproar, a run on the bank, you'll remember, and the children run away, very upset. Bert finds them, and now he says something that's very, very important as well. He says, now, there must be some mistake here. Your father is a fine gentleman. And he loves you. Your father's the one my heart goes out to. There he is in the cold, heartless bank day after day. I don't like to see anything caged up. And the children say, oh, fathers in a cage? Well, they make cages in all sizes and shapes, you know. Well, this is a rich field of investigation. Has patriarchy put a lot of men in cages? Of course it has. The rigid expectations there. Frequently, women are much more free than men to create the kinds of personalities that they wish to experience. And Bert says to the kids, you've got Mary Poppins to look after you and your mother and me. Who looks after your father? Oh, do you think father really needs our help? So the plot continues to thicken here. Mr. Banks is in deep trouble with the bank. He can't keep control of his children, who caused a run on the bank, and he is called in. Woe is him. And he says, it's that Poppins woman. Ever since she came, things have been happening to me. And he sings, my world was calm, well-ordered, exemplary. Then came this person with chaos in her wake. Now, I told it, remember, havoc. Chaos, havoc, anarchy are, you know, faces of the same phenomenon here. We could pause for a good discussion of all the fine work that's being done in looking at chaos theory, which is a necessary, wonderful next step to a different, higher kind of order. Chaos is a necessary thing. And now comes the transformation of the patriarchy here. Bert gives Mr. Banks an affectionate chastisement, saying, "Oh, yeah, you've got to grind, grind, grind at that grindstone, while childhood slips like sand through a sieve. And all too soon, they're up and grown, and then they've flown, and it's too late for you to give just that spoonful of sugar." Well, our patriarchy, Mr. Banks, is shaken. He really is. Everything's been pulled out from under him. And the children come in, and in a very pivotal, important little scene, they give love to him as they can. Michael reaches out with his little tuppence and says, "Here, Father, you can have the tuppence." Now, I am not saying no marches. I am not saying no letters, no petitions, no civil disobedience, no whatever it is that is your style of whatever to do. But I am saying let us not forget that the gesture, the simple gesture of love, is hugely powerful. The importance of compassion is huge. Well, Mr. Banks has been called in to the bank by the other presiding patriarchs that are there. And this scene is so great. The sourdough patriarchy in all of its comic extreme, in their black suits, in their hats, they in, and they perform a ritual. They take the flower from his lapel and crush it. They destroy his umbrella. They punch a hole through his hat. He is cast out. He is excommunicated. He's really at rock bottom now. And he has nothing to say. They ask him, "What do you have to say for yourself?" And he cannot think of one thing. And then it comes to him. And he looks at all of these sour, dour patriarchs and he says, "Yes, I know what to say. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious." And he begins to laugh. And they are even more horrified. And he laughs, and he laughs, and he laughs. And he sings and dances his way out of the bank. He says, when they say, "What are you going to do now?" He says, "I don't know. I might pop through a painting. I might..." Only Poppins would know. Ooh, wow. He says, "Only Poppins would know what I'm going to do now." Well, he has given himself over to the feminine. He has a new teacher. He has a new allegiance. And he sings and dances out of the bank. And at that moment, Admiral Boom, who is watching the weather, says, "The winds come around, blowing dead on from the west." It's my understanding that the west wind is warmer. Well, Mr. Banks disappears for a while, his family is worried, and then he comes up, you know, from the basement, having mended the kite that we saw at the beginning that he did not have time for, and he's singing, and then they all sing, "Let's go fly a kite." And what does Mrs. Banks do? Well, this is a very important thing. She says, "A proper kite should have a proper tail." And she gets what? She gets her ribbon that says "Votes for Women" on it. And she attaches that to the kite as the tail. Now, this is very, very heavy stuff. She does not need... Well, we should not have to fight. No woman in society, no woman, most particularly in our church, should have to fight for validation of the feminine principle, for validation of the female person, for access to our Divine Mother. But that's not the case yet. That can't happen yet. Because the wind has not yet changed. But it has for the Banks family. The family is healed. And the whole family is out there flying kites. And then what do we see as we pull back? The entire patriarchy is out there flying kites in their black uniforms and their smiles and their delight that that Mr. Banks made the old father die laughing and left a partnership open for him. So Poppins now then, seeing the transformation in the family and even the larger unit that has taken place there, she has finished her work and she ascends. Now, as I have told you the stories of these three movies, I don't know if you noticed that in all of them, the magical transforming female is named Mary. Which is a coincidence or a synchronistic archetypal event in that Mary seems to be the best name, the closest name we have to a holy woman. It would be interesting for you to sometime when you're visiting with your friends who are in this room or just on your own, to try to see where you feel we are in society and in the church particularly in terms of the story arc of these stories that I have rehearsed with you. I submit that, of course, the wind has not yet changed, but I think we are into the second act. I think Maria has come down from the hills and is dealing with the wrath of the captain and his occasional interest. But she's still, nevertheless, going about teaching the children to sing. I believe that Mary Lennox has discovered the garden and with Dickon is busily making green things grow. I believe that Mary Poppins has descended with her umbrella and is beginning her work. I certainly see myself as a player in this drama. And I'm very grateful for my role, and I hope that each of you see yourselves as an important player in the drama of transforming the patriarchy and inviting back the holy woman, the Divine Mother. I believe, too, that as we go about our work, that we can afford, as we can learn from the women that we have seen in these stories, that we can afford to be gracious, to be charming, and even sweet, because I really believe that history is on our side and that there is no going back, that the horse is out of the barn, as it were. And we must remember that this is not easy for the patriarchy to watch the transformation, those who do not have the vision of what's coming up next. For in the words of Brother Banks, who watched his patriarchal empire disappear in front of his eyes, he sings that all that is quite a bitter pill to take. And most particularly, I think we need to apply our best, most charming, whatever that means to you, most beautiful, whatever that means to you, most inviting, whatever that means to you, selves into the venture, for ultimately, in the words of Sister Poppins, Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down in the most delightful way. I thank you. It was suggested I leave a few minutes for questions or comments, so I think we have 10. Yes. How do you want to work the microphone for these folks? Oh, we don't have a microphone. We have lost this entire splendid talk. Well, that's too bad. Oh, okay. I'll repeat the question. Go ahead.
Okay, there's so much related to this we've been bombarded with all our lives. Return to the womb. Now we're getting stuff from some authorities about mothers with near incestuous relationships with their sons, clinging, not letting them go when they're supposed to go, teaching kids to fear God instead of loving, just wait till your father gets home. It seems like whatever's going on between the sexes involves a lot of misery. And the word you use is chaos. The misery is okay, and according to the adversity quotient, we can deal with adversity if we can see meaning in it.
Yeah.
You've got to have hope to stay alive, and hope comes from seeing meaning in adversity. So you almost mentioned where this is all leading, but you didn't really say.
Well,
the question is, why does there have to be so much misery between the sexes when the gospel teaches us that it's the highest order and the most beautiful, highest potential achievement that there is? Why so much misery involving
this guy has never given birth to a child. No, I think childbirth is a good possible image to keep in mind here. In fact, a child who is born without those intense contractions does not have some of the things that a baby, according to nature, needs to have just because of pain that a mother needs to endure. Why that is so, I don't know, and I'm not even going to suggest here, one, that this is anywhere near simple. You know, I've simplified things here. It gets hugely complex, and you can say, but there's this, and but there's that, and all those buts are absolutely true and must be addressed. However, it is my hope that as we go through what you have accurately said is huge misery in the possible relationship as men and women experience it. I still see a lot of delight and pleasure in male-female relationships, and I still hope that there is that possibility for everybody. But as you know, that the potential for misery is there and is huge. And what it all means for what I'm working for here, I don't know. I'm caught up in the chaos of everything, too. And I don't see the final end, but I know there's no going back. And I know the general thrust of moving out of patriarchy into partnership is something I'm willing to base my eternal salvation on. But there's plenty of unanswered questions. Yes. Mrs. Datfar, he's asking about. Listen, I'd need a little time to think that through. It's so convoluted. You know, that it's so convoluted, but it certainly does play out some of this stuff of transforming through adopting the feminine. Tootsie is certainly a superior piece, I think, even to that. But once you start looking around, you see it everywhere, and then you say, but wait, that doesn't fit here. And there is no real recipe where everything fits. But I just want to make a start thinking about some of this stuff. Yes. Yes, go ahead.
I really agree with you that our movies are our cultural myths. They are the place where we work out these issues. So I'm always fascinated by movies. Last weekend, I took my daughters to see The New Parent Trap. And, of course, that movie has been criticized because it is sort of unrealistic, you know, how many children get their parents back together. But when I was watching it, I had this sense of its mythic quality.
Oh, that's interesting,
and
yeah.
There, I think it's a very interesting version of what you're talking about, because there you have the two independent parents who are both very strong, especially in this newer version. They're both very delightful, wonderful parents. And it's the children, again, who get them back together. And it was funny, as I was watching it, I was thinking of the Jewish mysticism, where you have the idea that so many of our problems in the world are caused because the king and queen in heaven are separated. And in Jewish mysticism, it's up to the children. The children have to transform in order for the king and queen to come back together. So, I mean, I applaud the paper, and I think it's very important for us to think about our cultural myths and what they're telling us about our psyches and what we're working through as a culture.
Yes, thank you. For the tape, she's telling us about the new Parent Trap. Go see it. Yes.
I was interested in you bringing mysticism into your paper, and the thought occurred to me that most women that do get their name in history, be it a movie or history, that mankind has to make them mythical or supernatural in order to accept their role.
Yeah.
For example, the new Mulan who's out, or Joan of Arc. I mean, I know these are somewhat tried. That they were supernatural in order to accept their role in society at that time, because they were not within that patriarchal, narrow situation. How do we account for them? You already mentioned witches. Well, they must be witches because they're doing something that is so unusual. And I appreciated the mysticism of all three of these characters. That, why do we have to do that with women that are, they're ordinary, but we make them extraordinary?
Yeah, it's our business to make them so common that we can't any longer label them extraordinary. Let's do that. Eugene.
Well, I guess that was my question. It seems that we can all, even all us patriarchal males, can enjoy these movies and at some deep emotional level be satisfied by them and approve of them, but we don't translate it into everyday reality.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that so hard?
Well,
a form of sublimation, that it's a way of avoiding translating it every day, to go to the movie and say, oh, that's great, and feel these things there, but then make no application.
I'm sure of what you've said. It's hard to just make it come home and say, yeah, that pertains to me. You know, it's somebody else's thing out there, but I'm okay. And yet, nevertheless, our subconscious does receive some of this stuff, and it is subliminally coming in, I'm sure. Warren, this is my brother Warren right here.
I was just going to say that women, they go into politics, don't translate self-feminine.
Very often that is the case.
So,
he's saying very often women who go into politics become part of the patriarchy, as Mrs. Medlock was in The Secret Garden, sure. And I think if women do not take something uniquely feminine into the public sector, they just as well stay home. Yes, on the back.
Why will I go home and still play the same games with my husband after being here? Because when it's structured the way it is, it's real hard to take it home. And it's just like a little bit at a time.
Oh, no question. Teeny, teeny eighth of an inch every decade. Nevertheless, if we stay up in what I live up in what I call my spiritual helicopter for history in general, for my own life, because that's how the only way I can appreciate my own life is to hang up here above it and watch it go on. And when I'm up there, I can see how far we have come historically in terms of the kinds of things we're talking about, and certainly how much further we have to go. And the terrain is not clearly well mapped, but we are pioneers, and dang it, let's just keep our wagons moving. Yes?
You indicated in your paper that whether innate or what learned that the part of the feminine is to be not as concerned with competition as cooperation. Do you recommend any studies where maybe that's been shown with little girls or with people who are in different kinds of activities?
Well, one, Carol Gilligan did a landmark study called, what's the name of it? In a different voice. And that would lead you to all kinds of further work that has been done. Carol Gilligan.
I just follow up with that. With my personal experience of watching girls' athletic teams, they seem to just enjoy the game more, don't seem to be as competitive. They're more of a cooperative spirit. And yet in the workplace, I have not been able to distinguish much way that seem to interact as far as the competition is concerned.
Well, money talks, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Boy. But yeah, it is not a simple thing. Yes?
It seems to be a common assumption that at least several different varieties of feminism, and it seems to be an assumption that you accept too, that, that the feminine is somehow inherently maybe chaotic, passionate, emotional, creative. The masculine is inherently logical, rational, disciplinarian, militaristic. But at the same time, there seems to be a lot of just stark counterexamples to that. On my, for example, on my dissertation committee, I have two women who are logicians who outreason me any day of the week. Much better at doing mathematical proofs than I am. And then I know men who are
No question.
That complicates that kind of picture.
Well, sure it does. Absolutely. The plot thickens all the time. The little plot I've laid out for you thickens with every new... Well, but there's this, but there's that. You're right. Now, I don't know that... when I use the word chaos, of course, I was not calling it a feminine quality, but a step that we may be in as we move into a new way to acknowledge the feminine. And exactly what is the feminine and the masculine, I don't think anybody here knows. And we're just trying to figure that out. And maybe at the end of the day, if that ever comes, which may never because eternity never ends, who knows what we'll find. Right now, there are certain generalities, I think, that we have to work with, and that's all I'm trying to do. We seem to have, our time is up really, really, really fast here.
Well, I just wanted to bring out the point that if we consider that possibly we have a male and a female entity within us, or a part of ourselves, which is both male and female, and the female has let that little warrior part of herself that has been covered up for so many thousands of years, and as balance is coming, as we're going into the millennium, the masculine is coming more out in her, which is her warrior, as she is trying to balance herself. And the same is happening for men. He's getting more in touch with that feminine, nurturing part of himself, which is kind of scary at times, too. And so if we just consider this, we might see the wonderful balance is going to come in that warrior.
Yes, thank you for that. Now, I was going to make a mention, because we didn't have time, but I'm going to take 30 seconds since you brought it up. A wonderful book I read called The Writer's Journey by Chris Vogler, which is based on Joseph Campbell's work. He suggests that on the hero's journey, when each of them approaches the supreme ordeal, that the female hero accesses her masculine qualities and the male hero accesses his female qualities. And by doing that, they are able to succeed in the supreme ordeal and move forward. Well, may we all do that. Thank you so much.